This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Welcome back, True Crime Army. I am your host, Margot, and this is Military Murder, a show where I focus on crimes committed by military members and veterans, or against military members and veterans. But don't worry, you don't have to know anything about the military to listen. You just have to be a true crime enthusiast, and if that's you, welcome home. Today's episode is one of the oddest ones I've ever had to cover. Maybe it's because of the mystery surrounding the victim's death. A man who devoted his life to service for his country. A man who served in so many different capacities. This case involves a death, a murder investigated by various government agencies in one way or another, and yet a little over a decade later, and the case is still unsolved. So unsolved, in fact, that it made its appearance on the infamous newly remade Unsolved Mysteries on Netflix. Yep, we all remember the Unsolved Mysteries of old. But with these new seasons, we have seen some old cases get reopened. So the question remains, will today's case ever be solved? Join me today as I tell you the tragic story of Jack P. Wheeler III. Now, let's dig in.
Military Murder is an independent project and is not endorsed by the Department of Defense or any military component. The views expressed are those of the host. The content of this podcast is not meant to be legal or medical advice. Warning, this episode contains graphic details of murder and is not suitable for young listeners. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm going to take you back to 2010, if you can think back to that time. What were you doing on New Year's Eve 2010 as you prepared to welcome in 2011? Were you out shopping, maybe cleaning the house as you prepared to have friends and family over? Were you making your way into New York City to watch the infamous ball drop at midnight? I was crazy enough to do that one year, and let me tell you, never again. Maybe a few of you were actually working. Well, that's exactly what one employee of the Cherry Island landfill in Wilmington, Delaware was doing. He was watching at the landfill as dump trucks dumped trash into the landfill. But something caught this employee's eye as he looked on. He did a double take as he wondered if he really saw what he thought he saw. So you might be wondering, what did he see? Well, he could have sworn he saw a body come out of the dump truck and drop right there into a trash pile. The employee was shocked at the discovery and did not expect his last day of 2010 to be occupied by calling 911 because he found a dead body. But that's exactly what he had to do. When the police arrived on scene, they approached the body. It was the body of an older white gentleman. The man was cold to the touch and clearly deceased. He wore a black hoodie and appeared to be in his 60s, a little bit overweight, and he had a Rolex watch on and a West Point ring on his finger. When they checked the body, they found identification. It was 66-year-old Jack P. Wheeler III. Investigators were stunned, partially because it didn't appear that Jack's body had been in a dumpster for very long. When they looked up Jack's information, they found that he didn't live too far from the landfill. He actually lived up the road in Newcastle, Delaware. When the Wilmington police called the Newcastle police to inform them that they had one of their residents dead in the landfill, the Newcastle police were a little bit shocked and confused because when they heard the name Jack Wheeler, they remembered that they had just been called to Jack's house for a burglary call. A neighbor who had been house-sitting called it in. Jack was a married man and he had been married to his wife, Catherine, for 13 years, but she wasn't the one that called the burglary in because she was out of town. One of their neighbors who was house-sitting spotted the Wheeler house and thought it was suspicious because it was freezing cold outside and it was either an open door or there was an open window upstairs. When the neighbor walked into the home, he found the kitchen was in a bit of a disarray. There were broken dishes, a spilled powder substance in front of the kitchen sink, which appeared to be Ajax or Comet or something like that. Police tried to pinpoint anything that could have been stolen from the home, but they couldn't find anything. The TV was there, the stereo was there, even Catherine's expensive art collection was untouched. And inside the home, there were no clues leading detectives any closer to Jack's death. And when they notified Catherine that her husband was dead, she was devastated. You see, she wasn't notified until January 2nd, 2011, but she had been trying to get a hold of her husband since December 28th. They were set to go to a wedding on New Year's Eve, but when he failed to show up, Catherine went alone. Now, she realized Jack didn't show up because he was dead. Authorities needed to learn more about Jack P. Wheeler III, and they needed to learn this information stat. And their investigation would reveal a long line of government work, a recent feud with a neighbor, a lifelong struggle with bipolar disorder, and a personal vendetta against the Delaware government. But did any of these have anything to do with Jack's death? Jack Wheeler III was born in Laredo, Texas on December 14, 1944 to parents Jack Wheeler II and Janet Wheeler. Jack, from our story, the third, was the oldest of three kids. Jack's father, Big Jack, was a decorated Army colonel, and at the time of Jack's own birth, his father, Big Jack, was out at war commanding a tank battalion at the Battle of the Bulge. Little Jack is what we affectionately call a military brat, growing up in various military bases across the globe. When his family was stationed at Fort Monroe, Jack attended high school at Hampton High. Jack ran cross country and he showed his leadership skills from a very young age, leading the Russian and Spanish clubs in school. He was vice president of the Quill and Scroll, and he belonged to the National Honor Society and the Math Honor Society. Not surprisingly, his good looks and his smarts won him the most likely to succeed title his senior year of high school in 62. In deciding where to attend college, Jack turned down a National Merit Scholarship to attend Yale. Instead, he opted for West Point to keep in the tradition that his father started. And while attending West Point, Jack did not disappoint, earning the title of Distinguished Graduate of the graduating class of 66. Jack was first assigned as a fire control platoon leader in Franklin Lakes, New Jersey, but soon requested a delay in service to get a master's in business. And that he did. He attended Harvard Business School, graduating with distinction in 69 with an MBA. Straight out of Harvard, Jack was sent to Vietnam, where he served in admin, specifically logistics, until 1970. It should be noted that the Vietnam War was detrimental to the West Point class of 66. It is reported that the West Point class of 66 suffered one of the highest death rates of those that served in Vietnam. One of the Vietnam deaths that affected Jack the most was the death of Thomas J. Hayes IV, and after his death, Jack made it a point to honor his comrade. Jack left the Army in 71, and for a year he worked as a senior planner for Amtrak. Then he went to law school, attending Yale and graduating in 75. Jack was wicked smart, and he got a prestigious job clerking for a federal judge in the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. During this same period, Jack was married to his first wife, Elisa, and in 77, they welcomed twins, a boy and a girl. In 1978, Jack started working as a special counsel for the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. He was there for many years and left in 1986. While Jack was working with the SEC, he was working in the background to get a Vietnam memorial in D.C. off the ground. In the early 80s, Jack helped President Ronald Reagan create the Vietnam Veterans Leadership Program. From 83 to 88, Jack was the chairman and CEO of the Mothers Against Drunk Driving Initiative. In 84, Jack released his first book, Touched with Fire, The Future of the Vietnam Generation. He also contributed to a different book titled The Wounded Generation, America After Vietnam. You could tell that Jack wanted to leave a legacy for all the Vietnam-era veterans. From 88 to 89, Jack worked for President George H.W. Bush's transition team, and during this time, he founded the Earth Conservation Corps. During Jack's robust careers, plural because Jack had a hand in everything, as you can tell, he and his first wife divorced. In 1993, Jack met Catherine. She was a divorced mother of two, and after several years of dating, Jack and Catherine were married in 97. But Jack's marriage didn't slow him down one bit. From 97 to 2001, he was the president and CEO of the Deafness Research Foundation. And then from 2005 to 2008, Jack was a special assistant to the Secretary of the Air Force under President George W. Bush. Jack's main thing when he was SecAf's assistant was cyber warfare. You see, Jack P. Wheeler actually helped to create the Air Force Cyber Command. As reported by the News Journey, Jack was considered an authority on biological and chemical weapons. I feel like I need to pause just to catch my breath here, because can you believe this man's career? Well, in 2008, after decades of civil service, Jack retired. At his retirement, Jack was presented with the Air Force Exceptional Civilian Service Award with Bronze Device. In reading Jack's bio, I feel like many of you might be like, whoa. But that's not even everything he did, because his resume is even more impressive. During his career, Jack was the founding CEO of the Vietnam Children's Fund, which helped build 51 schools in Vietnam. He helped guide Macy's, yes, the Macy's store, out of bankruptcy. He helped create a book for Arlington Cemetery grieving families, and he spearheaded an effort to provide women service members with women-specific combat boots. Hello, comfy feet. The most impressive thing about Jack Wheeler's accomplishments is that he did it all while keeping his bipolar disorder at bay. Yep, Jack suffered from bipolar disorder, but he controlled it with medication. And while completely irrelevant to his accomplishments, but will come into play at the time of his death, Jack was terrible with directions. In his later years, he would park his car in a parking garage, and he would show up in his home in a taxi cab because he couldn't figure out where he left his car. I personally find it so fascinating that people can have such an impressive resume, and some of the more minor things just don't come naturally. Anyway, even though Jack retired from his official government work, he was still working. And later, Jack would work as a consultant for the MITRE Corporation, which is a government defense contractor. In the late 2000s, Jack and Catherine were splitting their time between two locations, Manhattan, New York, and Newcastle, Delaware. They were in their 60s, so they were trying to transition into retirement. But as you can imagine, retirement doesn't come easy for a man like Jack Wheeler. Whenever they were in Delaware, they tried to be at peace. They were prominent members of the Delaware community, and they lived in a historic area of Newcastle. I think it's called Old Newcastle. And they were living in a three-story brick house. They had a beautiful view of Battery Park and the Delaware River. Well, anyone who is as accomplished as Jack can be seen as braggy. I went to West Point, I went to Harvard, I went to Yale. His neighbors actually joked that Jack never boasted. In fact, he would often tell people he had a hard time holding down a job. And then, while living blissfully in Old Newcastle, Jack got wind that someone had purchased a plot of land right in front of his property, and they were intending to build a 2.5-story house, which would, in essence, block the Wheelers' view of the park and the river. The family that had purchased that plot of land were the Marinis. Well, the Wheelers were not happy, and they were not going to sit by quietly as their retirement view was taken over by someone else's house. So, what did they do? They sued to stop the construction of the Marini house. The Wheelers argued that the plot of land they purchased was of historic importance. And Catherine said that Jack threw himself into the legal fight, and he was as intense can be. Jack went around and actually got 82 residents to agree with him, and they all signed a petition to stop the construction in order to save Battery Park. But the courts were not having it, and the Marinis were granted permission to continue their build. But that didn't stop Jack, because he continued the legal fight despite the court's ruling. With this legal battle going on in the background, Jack was a consultant with the MITRE Corporation in D.C., and he would take the train from Delaware to D.C. for work. And for Christmas 2010, which is where our story kind of began, Jack spent Christmas in New York with his wife and the kids in a property they owned there. After the Christmas holiday, Catherine thought that they would head to the movies, you know, spend some time together. But instead, on December 28th, without prompting, Jack told Catherine he had to go to work in D.C. He said he had some work to get done for MITRE. He planned to stay in downtown D.C. Catherine was pissed. WTF, they were retired. It was the holidays. Couldn't whatever he had to do wait until after January 1st? Well, no, that's what Jack said. That very day, December 28th, Jack left with a few of his things, including his black briefcase, which he never left out of his sight. That was the last time that Catherine saw her husband alive, although the argument continued throughout that day over text. But after the morning of December 29th, it was crickets. From that day forward, whenever she tried to reach Jack, his phone went straight to voicemail. And that wedding on New Year's Eve? Well, it was a cousin's wedding. So when Catherine didn't hear from Jack, she went without him. When investigators found Jack's body in the landfill, they got to work retracing the steps of the dump truck. I have covered a case before where they were able to pinpoint exactly what stops the truck made before arriving at the landfill. Well, investigators determined that Jack's body had been in a commercial trash bin left in one of 10 locations on the east side of Newark, Delaware. The garbage trucks began picking up trash there at about 4:20 a.m. Based on Jack's location inside the truck, Jack's body had been picked up earlier in the route. Detectives backtracked even further, getting all the way back to December 13th. That day was significant because it was the day that a judge denied Jack's temporary restraining order against the Marinis. But from that day until right before his disappearance, Jack seemed fine. On December 28th, Jack left New York for DC, and that day during his travel, all seemed well. Jack emailed his attorney, he posted on a West Point Class of 66 message board. All seemed normal. At about 7:30 p.m., Jack left D.C. on an Amtrak back to Delaware. He called a few cabs, but his whereabouts that evening through the night are unknown. However, Jack did email his wife in an attempt to make up, and he emailed his daughter and his stepdaughter. But on that very night, something very odd happened near Jack's home. More specifically, his neighbor, the Marini's home. That night, at about 11:30 p.m., one of Jack's neighbors saw someone wearing a hat, dark pants, and a gray sweatshirt throwing something on fire into the Marini home. The neighbor watched as the man threw something inside and then calmly walked away into the night. The neighbor immediately called 911. Firefighters arrived and found smoke bombs consistent with those used to control rodents. While the Marini home was not ruined, the smoke bombs did damage an unfinished floor. And as the fire team searched inside the home, they found Jack Wheeler's phone inside of the Marini home, which, what? This is so suspicious considering that the Wheelers and the Marinis were not on good terms. The morning of December 29th was the last time Jack's family heard from him over email. That morning at about 8:45 a.m., Jack took a cab to the Hotel DuPont. As Jack made casual conversation with the cab driver, at 9:30 a.m., Jack emailed MITRE and informed them he was the victim of a home break-in. He reported to them that his phone, badge, key fob, and briefcase had been stolen. Jack also emailed his therapist and said he was feeling dazed and boxed in a corner after his disagreement with his wife. As reported by the Washington Post, Jack sent several emails that day, but given that his phone was lost, it's unclear how Jack was able to send those emails. That night, December 29th at around 6 p.m., Jack was seen on surveillance at a Newcastle drugstore just a few blocks from his house. He asked the pharmacist for a ride to Wilmington, but the pharmacist declined. He told Jack that he could call him a cab, but Jack said never mind. The pharmacist remembered that Jack looked upset. He wore a black suit with a white shirt. 42 minutes later, Jack was seen in a parking garage in Wilmington near the Newcastle County Courthouse. The video showed Jack wandering around, half confused, half lost. Before this video, Jack was clothed from top to bottom. Now, Jack was seen on video speaking to the office attendant wearing a black suit, no tie, with only one shoe. He was actually carrying his other shoe in his hand. Jack's collar was open and his left sleeve jacket had dirt on it. Jack told the attendant he wanted to find a place to warm up before paying for parking. But the attendant realized that Jack wasn't even parked in that parking garage. Jack said someone robbed his briefcase, but he didn't want anyone to call the police. Jack repeated over and over again that he wasn't drunk, and the attendant believed him because Jack's speech was clear and he didn't smell of alcohol. I think the parking attendant kind of felt bad for Jack, so they offered him money, but Jack said no, stating he had plenty of money. Jack wandered around some more and left at around 7:05 p.m. Where he stayed that night, nobody knows. The following morning, December 30th at 8 a.m., Jack is seen at a Subway sandwich store where he ordered a coffee. He didn't look good, and the employees thought he was a homeless man. His shirt was dirty, he had bloodshot eyes. Later that afternoon, at 3:30 p.m., Jack was seen near 10th and Orange Street. He was six blocks from his attorney's office. Jack walked into the Small Business Administration office, stayed for about 5 minutes, and then asked for a ride to Philadelphia. It doesn't appear that anyone agreed, and then Jack left the building. That night at 8:30 p.m., Jack was seen on surveillance video in the same building, the Nemours building. He asked to speak to a partner at a law firm, but he left before speaking to anyone. He appeared confused, but more shocking to investigators was the fact that Jack was wearing a different suit than the one he had on earlier, which they wondered, where did he get this suit and when did he change? But wait, that wasn't all. Jack, who never wore a sweatshirt, was wearing a sweatshirt over top of his suit, and the hoodie was over his head. Jack is then seen leaving the Nemours building. He walks through the Hotel DuPont valet parking area and continues walking. At 8:45 p.m., Jack was seen on footage for the last time, walking towards the east side, which the News Journey reported as being a low-income neighborhood riddled with crime. This was the last time, as far as I could tell, that Jack was spotted on camera. That same night, a neighbor friend of the Wheeler, as I had mentioned earlier, had been house-sitting for the Wheelers when he saw that the door was open or one of the windows was open. In that moment, the neighbor figured that someone in the Wheeler family left in a rush. They tried to reach Jack, but he didn't answer. The following day, on the 31st, the house sitter contacted Catherine, and she thought it was odd because she hadn't heard from her husband either. Unbeknownst to Jack's family, at 10 a.m. on the 31st, Jack Wheeler was found in a landfill. An investigator surmised that Jack had been dumped somewhere in Newark, around 14 miles from his last known location. While investigating Jack's death, investigators determined that his home was not the crime scene and that although the house was in a bit of a disarray, it was not the scene of any crime. Presumably, they believed that someone with access made the mess. After notifying Jack's next of kin, the Newark police publicly named Jack as the person found at the landfill. Jack's family, friends, and neighbors were all shocked. His attorney, the one representing him in the lawsuit against the Marinis, was equally shocked, stating that Jack wasn't the typical murder victim and that guys like him don't usually end up murdered and in a landfill. When asked, the attorney quickly shut down the idea that Jack was murdered due to the lawsuit over the property. As investigators dug, they found Jack's car in a hotel parking lot near the Amtrak station. Sources are divided on when it was first parked at the hotel. One source said it was parked there on December 13th. Another said Christmas Eve. For weeks, the public wondered how Jack died, but they didn't have to wonder for long because on January 28, 2011, the medical examiner announced Jack's cause of death. He had been beaten to death in an assault with an object or body part. His cause of death was blunt force trauma. It was later revealed he also suffered a heart attack, but authorities wouldn't release the location of the trauma, you know, from the blunt force trauma, nor would they say anything about the toxicology report. The only thing that they commented on was that toxicology didn't play a role in Jack's death. Jack's family was desperate for answers, and on January 30th, they announced a $25,000 reward for information leading to an arrest in Jack's murder. The family attorney told the media that the Wheeler family was upset with how tight-lipped the police were. In fact, the family hadn't even heard about Jack's cause of death until they read about it in the paper. And then, on February 15th, police did another search of Jack's house, and this time they took some evidence. But of course, they didn't reveal anything about what they took or why. 2 days after this search, a news article in Slate was released. In this article, they interviewed Catherine, Jack's wife, and she told them how frustrated she was with the investigation. She said they were making her life miserable. She said the cops treated everyone in the family like a criminal, and the conflicting information that the police did give her caused her pause, and she questioned that they even knew what they were doing. Catherine admitted she viewed the last known videos of Jack and said he was fine. He always had a terrible lack of direction, but she made sure people realized that Jack was not demented or suffering from any mental health crisis. In May, Jack's wife and son, John P. Wheeler IV, did a sit-down interview with USA Today and the News Journal of Wilmington. Catherine said they still didn't have any answers and that there were so many unsolved questions. Throughout the months, she wondered if Jack's career had anything to do with his death. She discussed the assassination theory and specifically she said, quote, he had lots of enemies, but nobody that would kill him, end quote. Which is really weird, right? While Catherine always said her husband was fine, she did admit that he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and he did take medication. She didn't think he was off his meds at the time that he died, although she can't explain his inexplicable behavior, i.e. leaving New York, not answering his phone, wandering around and asking for a cab. After this interview, media attention for Jack's unsolved case was sparse. The police never found the crime scene. They weren't even able to narrow down which dumpster Jack was left at, which I think is very interesting. Crickets for years. And then, in 2007, the Washington Post released an article about Jack Wheeler III. But in addition to the mysterious unsolved murder of Jack, the article mentioned that Jack was the prime suspect in that attempted arson of the Marini's home just days/hours before Jack's death. Now that is weird. And if you're anything like me and thought that maybe Jack just walked into the wrong neighborhood, well, authorities aren't believing that theory of the case either. Not only because there is no evidence, but also the fact that Jack was found with his identification and wearing a Rolex watch, well, that led investigators to believe that it probably wasn't a good theory. You know, the robbery theory, the beating up this random guy who walks into the wrong neighborhood. And police also realized that when someone walks into a bad neighborhood and they're beaten and killed, the people don't actually go all that way to put the person in a dumpster. They just leave them there. Anyway, as for Jack trying to burn down the Marini house, apparently part of the evidence they found at Jack's house included a receipt for black clothing and a receipt for a full face ski mask. And don't forget, Jack's cell phone was found in the Marini house. Catherine admitted that Jack had actually told her that he might burn down the Marini house, but Catherine didn't think he would really do it. Catherine told the Washington Post that she felt that maybe Jack was involved in some computer hacking that might have caused his murder. She said that for weeks and months before his death, Jack felt that the Delaware government was corrupt, primarily because of their dealings with the Marini house. So Jack had asked a friend to connect him with a hacker or to teach him how to do it himself. The thing is that these are all just theories, and the case is still unsolved. For any children of the 80s and 90s like myself, unsolved mysteries was a way of life. I mean, I have been into true crime for as long as I can remember, and it's due to shows just like Unsolved Mysteries. Well, you know it was revamped for Netflix. Jack Wheeler's unsolved case was featured in the renewed Unsolved Mysteries show, which aired on October 2020. Jack's case is still unsolved. If you or anyone you know has any information regarding Jack Wheeler's death and murder, please reach out to the Delaware Crime Stoppers line at 1-800-TIP-3333, or you can visit DelawareCrimeStoppers.com. If you are interested in seeing some of the footage I discussed today, make sure you check out that Unsolved Mysteries episode on Jack's case. Shout out to Haley Gray for researching this episode and for recommending it to me to begin with. My sources for this episode include various articles in The News Journey, AP News, Philadelphia Daily News, The Philadelphia Inquirer, The Daily Press, USA Today, Slate, and The Washington Post. Military Murder is a Mama Margot production. Shout out to this episode's newest assistant producer, Sai. The theme music was created by Tyops. If you're interested in supporting this show, be sure to check out patreon.com/militarymurder or Apple Premium subscription, where for $5 a month, you can get access to over 40 full-length episodes. All right, everyone. Until next time, remember, You never really know what someone is capable of, so remain vigilant always. You have a fabulous week, and I'll keep digging to bring you another military murder story next week.
Mama's working on her podcast.